KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. In 2018, Nathan Grossman started filming a young, unknown climate activist who ended up leading a global movement. Grossman was there when Greta Thunberg started protesting climate change, sitting on a sidewalk outside the Swedish parliament. In his new film, I Am Greta, he documents her rise to international icon. He followed Thunberg as she met with world leaders, and he tagged along when she made a harrowing journey from Sweden to New York in a very small boat.
Someone showed it to a very important financier in Hollywood, and the only comment that came was like, I'm getting nauseous of the kind of, I'm getting seasick by watching this.
Grossman explains why he went along for that ride. But first on the News Banter, Murdoch versus Trump. Who'd have thunk it? Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, interesting going on in the aftermath of the election. We have seen Donald Trump attacking Fox News. He is mad at Fox News because, in part, Fox News had called Arizona early on the night of the election. There was a lot of drama around that. Turned out to be right, though, but I think the Trump camp felt that that changed the narrative and the sense of momentum that Trump seemed to have in the early going. And since then, you know, the non-opinion people on Fox have been kind of glued to reality and referred to Joe Biden as the president-elect. And this kind of thing incenses Trump and his supporters. So we are seeing him tweeting, and we're seeing these little competitors that hadn't really done that much in terms of audience. Some of them seem to be picking up audience, possibly because the Trump Republicans, and we've seen 70 million people voted for Trump, so that's a lot of people. Some of them seem to be turning away from Fox and to more right-wing competition.
Yeah, and this has been the kind of open secret within Fox News for years. They get a lot of attention because they are the only conservative-oriented outlet and they have very opinionated hosts. But the internal research at Fox, I'm told, has always shown that about a third of its viewers wish it was more conservative, not less. So this is the lane that some of these competitors are trying to get into. And you have Newsmax, you have OAN. Both of those have really put out a welcome mat for some of these aggrieved Trump fans who don't want to live in the real world and want to live in this fantasy world where Trump is going to be president for four more years. And at least in the short term, it seems to be working.
Yeah, if you look at these numbers that Brian Stelter at CNN wrote about, he said that in the final week of October, Newsmax, which is a more right-wing outlet, was averaging 65,000 viewers at any given time. Not a huge number. As we went into the election, that started to go way up. And in the aftermath of the election, some of their evening shows, Spicer and Company, are reaching 700,000 and 800,000 viewers. That is a really huge spike. I think a big question is, does it last? And another big question is, what does Trump do? You know, there's talk that he's going to start something digital. I think starting something new, and I'm not the only one, I mean, this is not a unique opinion that I have, starting something new in this environment, this noisy environment, is going to be difficult, but that does not mean Trump will not be noisy somewhere.
Yeah, and he could do various different things where he lends his name to a programming block, or he hosts a show, or, you know, everything up to taking over one of these networks and branding it Trump TV. You know, but that, I think, loses sight of the fact that Fox News is Fox News for a bunch of different reasons. Only part of it is because it's conservative. If you look at the product that they put out, and this is from the very beginning with Roger Ailes at the helm, it is a slick and well-produced product. They put money into it. And if you look at some of these shows on OAN or on Newsmax, I mean, these shows, some of them look like they're coming out of a basement. They have more in common with some of these video products that the radio hosts put out on YouTube or elsewhere. They don't look like this gleaming, you know, Roger Ailes used to talk about the vibrant screen, where if you look at it, it commands your attention. And that's what Fox has. These others don't. So I think it's going to, in the short term, I think there's some upside for these, but long term, if I'm Rupert Murdoch or Lachlan Murdoch, I'm not too afraid of these competitors.
Certainly not a standoff I expected to see, but however conservative Rupert and Lachlan Murdoch are, Rupert is definitely a pragmatist. We can remember when he was buddies with Tony Blair, and who is not a conservative in Britain. So, you know, I think Rupert Murdoch is, you know, he may be old, but he seems to be eternal right now.
And remember, there was a lot of talk when Glenn Beck left Fox News. I mean, he was the most popular host on Fox News for many years, and he left and started his own thing. And that had a little bit of a run, but then it ultimately petered out, and Fox News is back where it is. And Rupert and Lachlan are going to figure out what the next incarnation of Fox is in a Joe Biden era. And I'm betting it will look a lot like what Fox was during the Obama years, and it'll be very successful.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Let me turn to Disney. Disney has been struggling with the pandemic, as we've discussed. They've just released earnings as we're speaking. And for this year, they have really done, as we've said before, incredibly well. We see the subscriber numbers. They haven't had that much new stuff, but there's a chart that shows the spike from Hamilton, which was released in July, and basically the effect, I think, felt in this past quarter. And that is a really high spike. And so they now have 73 million viewers ahead of their estimates. I think their estimate's pretty conservative considering they're Disney, but they can celebrate that. And certainly the stock is going up.
We should put a grain of salt on this because they did report a loss, their first loss since 2001. So it's not like everything is humming at the Walt Disney Company. They have serious problems, especially at the theme park division, because some of their parks are still closed, especially in California, and the revenue from the others is just not where it was. But the stock immediately popped after earnings for one reason, and that is because the numbers on Disney Plus were very good. I mean, 74 million subscribers less than a year into the service. That's amazing. I mean, that is beyond anyone's hope for the service. And they've done it with relatively few originals. They've taken their swings, and Hamilton was a big swing. This quarter also encompassed Mulan, which they did an experiment on and put in for $30 on Disney Plus. But there hasn't been that much original content, and still they've gotten to these numbers. Imagine what's going to happen over the next few years when they really start pumping a lot of originals onto Disney Plus.
Yeah, they're still going through what we're going through. They do have some stuff coming up. They have Soul, the Pixar movie, coming in December. They have WandaVision, the first Marvel show, coming also next year. They are, however, telling us that costs related to the pandemic in fiscal year 2021 will total about $1 billion. So pain is not over yet, but maybe with a talk of a vaccine, we're going to get somewhere and life will eventually get better. We can hope. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Coming up after a short break, Nathan Grossman, the filmmaker behind I Am Greta, explains that Greta Thunberg's father is a big character in the movie, partly because he's a hemipapa. That's Swedish for a stay-at-home dad. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Greta Thunberg started out at 15, sitting alone outside the Swedish parliament. Her protests started gaining momentum in Sweden, then spread through the rest of Europe and abroad. Before long, she was invited to meet with political leaders, including French President Emmanuel Macron. And eventually, she spoke at the United Nations.
You are failing us. But the young people are starting to understand your betrayal. The eyes of all future generations are upon you. And if you choose to fail us, I say we will never forgive you.
Filmmaker Nathan Grossman was there from the very beginning. He's documented her rise to one of the world's most prominent climate change activists in his new film, I Am Greta, now streaming on Hulu. Grossman was working for a production company in Stockholm when he heard about a young teenager on a school strike, hoping to influence the Swedish election. At first, Grossman thought he might make a short film about Thunberg. Then he thought it might work as a film for Swedish public broadcasting. Eventually, he was talking to Hollywood. Before all that, though, Grossman had to make sure Greta was worth filming.
My boss said, like, 1 or 2 days, go down there and have a look if it's a character worth filming. So I went to this tiny street where Greta then was striking before the Swedish election, and asked her, you know, can I film you for a day or two? And don't get your hopes up if I decide not to kind of continue further. And from there, I started filming.
So at first, she's not a immensely immediately outgoing person. So did you think this is a fail?
Yeah, I remember speaking to her first and remembering that she was very shy and it was a little bit kind of hard to fully understand her character. But as we started to speak about climate-related questions, she was kind of so articulate. And I remember when, you know, the people walking by asked questions to her and other journalists came by and also started to conversate with her. It struck me that she had a very interesting way of formulating herself around this issue. And I remember I had my headphones on and I looked at the sound guy and we were like nodding and we were like, she can probably be worth filming.
At what point, I mean, she does catch fire as a person who's leading a movement. I know you shoot her with Macron in France. Is that where it starts to be, the momentum builds, or was it even before that?
No, but I think it was a bit before that. At office, they always called me the pessimistic guy in the sense that I tend to think that stories kind of, I don't know if they're going to work or translate. But it was sometime during the winter of 2018, suddenly the strikes, these climate strikes, they kind of popped out of the Nordics and in Australia and Belgium, tens of thousands of children were striking and, you know, holding up signs saying, you know, we stand with you, Greta. And I think during that kind of winter when I saw that Greta's words were translating outside of this kind of fairly small group in the Scandinavians, that was when I understood that this was going to become much bigger. And that was also when the movement kind of took off and she got invited to join many of those marches and meet with political leaders.
At what point does your boss tell you, just this is a film, go ahead?
Yeah, but I think it's somewhere around that time. And my boss, I think, has like during that winter, maybe think of, you know, wrapping up the production and the financing with just the kind of Nordic channels. But at that moment, I traveled with my other producer, Cecilia, to Copenhagen Docks. And we pitched a project more on an international level, and I also start to work full-time on it.
You mostly shot on your own, right? And I assume that was to help build the connection without having tons of people in the space?
Yeah, that was one part of it, of course. But it was also, from the beginning, a small part of being a small project and not being heavily funded. But also, I wanted to continue doing that because getting into many of these rooms with these top political leaders can be such a hassle. And as the movie is made as a kind of fly on the wall, and you know, I didn't want to kind of intrude on the activism. I wanted to follow it. I quickly understood that there were so many benefits of kind of shooting it myself, and I have a background as a cinematographer, even though I haven't shot for a few years because I've been fortunate enough to work with great DOPs. I decided on this project that I will actually kind of put that heavy piece of machinery on my shoulder again because I felt that it would both take us closer to her and also get us into those closed down political rooms.
Yeah, in some cases you didn't get in. I read there's like a 50-50 whether you got whether you would get in or not. With Obama, for example, I think it was a no.
Yeah. And I must say that doing this documentary, many people have asked me afterwards, like, what was the hardest thing? And they, of course, think I will answer something with how hard it was getting Greta's trust and so on. But I must say that the hardest thing was getting into these political meetings, because like Greta and these young climate strikers, they always wanted me to join because they wanted to show that they kind of, you know, spoke truth to power. Many of these powerful politicians were very reluctant to have an independent filmmaker coming in and showing their one-on-ones, which I think is a little bit sad. I think it's important for us as filmmakers to be able to join those rooms, at least to some extent. And of course, I filmed for a long time, and I was lucky enough to get into enough places to show how Greta kind of addresses these politicians and that she is very true to herself and to the kind of cause in kind of bringing up these numbers and these statistics that she wants to present, even when she's in those kind of inner rooms. But as a filmmaker, it was very hard getting in there.
Her father is a big part of the film and just devoted dad. And I don't know if they set parameters. I know we didn't see that much of her mom. Did they say you can film this but not film that?
No, not that kind of hard parameters in a sense. I was very open to them, both Greta and later on the family, that I, you know, wanted to work freely and you know, to do my point of view on them and access to kind of the most things I got very freely. But that the mother wasn't that much in the movie also comes down a lot to the movie being kind of a road movie. And we spent much of the time filming actually on trains, electric cars, on these meetings and events, and of course to some extent at home, and thus the father kind of became the main character besides Greta, because he's kind of what we call in Sweden hemma pappa, which is I think if you translate it to English it would be like an at home dad. So it's not very common maybe in other parts of the world, but in Sweden we have those. So he has the time to go and travel with her, and in that sense, he became like a really good character to bounce Greta's thoughts and feelings towards.
And you do see her at moments getting very stressed out, and he obviously is experienced with that and has ways of trying to help her manage when she's overwhelmed.
Yeah, and I think what was important for me in this portrayal was, of course, to try to show kind of the full extent of this very emotional year and the activism that Greta was embarking on. And I think in the film you get to see many of the reactions that she's having to things that are kind of funny and weird and positive, but of course many situations were tough it takes a lot of energy going around and kind of sometimes like banging your head against some kind of a brick wall in a way that you're saying things to politicians and they seem to just be nodding and taking selfies. I think I've said that it's probably something which is very hard for many of us to understand it fully, because it's like maybe like a bad relationship when you're like over and over and over, over again saying, you know, you have to address this behavior and that person ignores you. Then, like in normal life, you would break up. But I think in Greta's case, she, you know, you can't break up with this important issue and with the world of politics in that sense. So she had to kind of continue her saying her message, which sometimes was hard.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about she decides to sail across the Atlantic, and I have to tell you, clearly you seem to have gotten on that boat with her, and there is like, I would rather have, you know, dental surgery every day than do that. It looked horrible. But did you just say, I got to do this with her?
No, it was a process for me. And I think it's for anyone who watches the film, I remember that someone showed it to a very important like top financier in Hollywood. And the only comment that came was like, I'm getting nauseous of the kind of, I'm getting seasickness by watching this. This is, it's a great film, but take down the seasickness in the end. And of course, it was a very kind of bumpy and special ride going on that sailing boat. I think, remember, for viewers, it's maybe important to note that this is not like a sailing yacht, as you see in the marinas and in some of the nicer parts of the country. It's a racing boat. They don't even paint the inside of the boat to kind of keep the weight down. And I remember when she told me that about this idea, and I was like, you know, whew, okay, I've been filming this movie myself to a large extent because I really believe in that way of doing this documentary. But now I need to find someone who's, you know, experienced in filming like a sailing trip, because I can't do this. I'm out. But after speaking to the captain a little bit and a little bit more to Greta, I understood that it would be bumpy, but not necessarily dangerous to do it. And then I felt that I wanted to go on the trip myself, also to be able to continue that into the UN and to this speech that she was going to have in the United Nations.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear when you watch the film how basic and stripped down. And I think probably very boring to sit on the boat where just waiting. How many days was that journey?
Yeah, Kim, that's a really good analysis. And I think it's interesting you bringing that up. I think many people kind of maybe miss how long time it takes. It took a little bit more than 2 weeks, which we, of course, now know it's about the same time it takes to quarantine for COVID. So imagine that time being in a bumpy sardine box. So you have to find your kind of methods of kind of getting over the boredom and sometimes your own kind of fear of the ocean. I was a little bit feared of that. Greta seemed not to be. So we spent lots of time talking, and we spent lots of time just kind of on almost like, I wouldn't say meditating, but it's this, you know, state where you just sit and watch kind of the ocean and try to kind of just detach your head. And which was also very funny is that some people have a very hard time sleeping on these boats because it's so rocky. But both me and Greta, we went into this kind of sleeping flow where we could sleep like 10, 12 hours per night, you know, because it was a little bit, yeah, you didn't have anything to do during the day. And then the boat rocking was maybe like a cradle that kind of made you sleep well. But at the other hand, the three kind of adults, the strong ones, the two captains and her father, they had a really hard time sleeping. They couldn't sleep for more than like half an hour or a few hours. So I think it says a lot about how different you can react to an adventure like that.
It just seems like I'm still in horror just from the idea of it. But you do see her in moments of distress on that boat where she says the mission is too much for her.
Yeah, definitely. And I think especially in the beginning of the sailing trip, it was a bit harder to kind of get used to it. Later on, she went more into it. But I think that specific scene says a lot about kind of, I think, how important it is for us to remember that these young people, and it's not only Greta, we have many fantastic climate activists that has been part of these school strikes and other climate movements for the last couple of years. They are a fantastic alarm bell, and they want us to listen to them, and they want to kind of ring that bell, but they don't want to kind of get the responsibility shoved up on their shoulders in a sense. And I think maybe sometimes that's what we've done with many of these young climate activists, and with Greta maybe being kind of on the top of that, that we've kind of embraced them and we've listened to them, and that's great. But we've also kind of put in so much responsibility onto young people's shoulders that we as adults actually should take. We are the ones who carry the economic and political power, and we are the ones who need to address this issue. And these young people, they're calling for action, but at the same time, they're just getting met by applause and you know, people taking selfies. And I think that scene really shows that that's not how it should be done, you know.
As we are speaking, the U.S. has just come out of the Paris Climate Accord officially, and COVID has shut the world down to a huge extent, so the marches are not And, you know, we've had Black Lives Matter in the United States and elsewhere around the world. So where do you see the movement right now?
No, of course, it's a hard kind of hard to know exactly where the world is heading at this moment. I think it's definitely the time where we've seen any speculations going wrong. But sadly, the only thing I know we can speculate in is that climate change is real and that it's getting worse. In the sense that for like every day going, we have more and more pollutants kind of getting out into the atmosphere, and our carbon budget is sinking. And the more kind of pollution we're spending now, the less we have in the future. So it's going to be really tough for us to kind of get in line with what we need to create a safe future for these young people and for their children. And I think the climate movement will in that way become stronger and stronger, because we will see more and more effects of climate change coming. And one part of maybe not including kind of COVID as a part of this specific documentary is because I think we need to be able to see this documentary in the future as a piece disconnected from a very important crisis, the COVID crisis. But we also need to remember that that's a short-term crisis. It's something that we will solve within a specific time. I don't know how long, but some more short time if you compare it to climate change, which is this kind of long-term issue. And I think that the movie, as it's kind of made right now, it's kind of a little bit disconnected from that. So we can watch it in the future and kind of and have it as a piece of showing how important it is for young people to have their voices heard, but also again not to be taken as kind of hostages and held responsible for coming up with all the solutions, because that's something we need to do collectively. To conclude, of course, definitely we're in a situation. We're recording this when we don't know if it's Trump or Biden who's going to be the president, but whoever of them becomes president of the United States, we're in a situation where we need drastic measures very quickly, and we're not really seeing that, which is, I totally understand that young people will not become more kind of optimistic of how their future will look like if however this goes.
Greta, for now, has to stay home because of the COVID crisis.
Yeah, here in Sweden, we're having it's not like a lockdown, but of course,
you had a specific approach which has been very controversial, and lots of chatter about it, which is less lockdown.
Exactly, we're having our weird way here, but the school strike movement with Greta has been very quick in kind of practicing as they preach, which I think is very Greta-ish, in the sense of that they've been so open about that we need to listen to the scientists when it comes to climate change. And when the scientists, when it came to this health crisis, said that it's important that we keep distance and limit ourselves from big kind of gatherings, they shut down the climate strikes here and limited them to become digital or very small. So, of course, they're monitoring what's happening around the world, and I'm sure that that these strikes and other parts of climate activism will kind of come up back again after the COVID crisis is maybe calming itself down a little bit.
Nathan Grossman is the director of I Am Greta, now streaming on Hulu. Thank you very much for doing this interview from Stockholm.
Thank you, Kim, for having me.
And that's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh and Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help from Mario Diaz. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.